support for this KQED podcast comes from ACT, presenting Stephen Sondheim's rapturous musical, A Little Night Music. Featuring an all-star cast, A Little Night Music begins performances at ACT's Geary Theater May 20th. ACT-SF.org.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Mina Kim. In this hour of Forum, design and innovation. David Kelly, the founder of IDEO, is here. IDEO is widely regarded as one of the world's most influential design companies. David Kelly designed the first commercial mouse for Apple and was a close collaborator with Steve Jobs. He also founded the D School at Stanford. Talk with him about his collaborative approach to creative problem solving and how to unleash your imagination and create a culture of creativity in any organization, including government. We'll get started with Forum right after this. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Mina Kim. And in this hour, my guest is David Kelly. Now, he may not be a household name in your house, but as founder of the design firm IDEO and the Stanford D School, he's had a big impact on what's known as human-centered design, incorporating the needs of people into the design of products, services, and organizations. He's also co-written a book with his brother Tom. It's titled Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within All of Us. David Kelly, so good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
Let me begin just by asking you a simple question. Finish this sentence. The thing that makes design thinking different from other approaches to design is what?
Is that it's so incredibly human-centered. I mean, so many other approaches involved, like coming up with a technology and then trying to hope that people will, you know,
adapt.
Resonate with it, yes. And we go the other way. We try to really understand what's meaningful to people. The number one thing about our approach is empathy. Empathy for people, looking for non-obvious needs that people have, and then we exploit them by coming up with solutions that really will delight them or solve their problems, whatever. So it's the human-centeredness that makes design thinking different.
And that's interesting because, you know, it's talking about stereotypes of people who work in, say, the tech industry, where so much of this design has been incorporated, is that they're not necessarily people.
Right.
So is that – how do you get around that? How do you design empathy into people? You can't really
do that.
Well,
it's funny because, that's the opportunity for us because it's there's so much kind of low-hanging fruit if you're a people person. So but we really – what happens is – what we use an approach we call guided mastery, which is we take students, and a lot of them are, you know, like afraid to get out of the car when we get to the place where the people are, you know, because they haven't done it before.
You got to talk to people.
But they trust us, I guess, and they go in. And what happens is that it just seems, especially the techies, it just seems to turn them on to have this feeling that I'm going to help this person. They feel the need kind of in their bodies. And so it's really motivating, right? Compared to you're sitting in a room, in a meeting room with your laptops open and a bunch of people talking to each other, that, you know, this kind of what we call bias towards action, when you're really there and you really feel the need, you know, and especially, you know, in developing countries or especially in where people are really struggling to feel that need, they go back to their, you know, soldering irons and what they know. And they're so much more motivated than they were before. And so we see that as really compelling.
So is part of all this human-centered design and the empathy part of it, is it letting go of your own assumptions?
Well, it's certainly looking at the world with a more childlike mind, we say, or, you know, trying to understand what is really meaningful to people. So your assumption, you know, the things that if you just try to come up with ideas off the top of your head or with your other buddies around the room, those ideas are mostly cliched and not kind of able to be exploited into really breakthrough ideas. It seems that you know, your assumptions go away when you're actually physically in the location. You know, if you're if you're watching people take a train in Africa, I mean, you didn't have the right vision of what that was like you know, sitting in Palo Alto.
You made a lot of assumptions.
You made a lot of assumptions, right? And so you are challenging your assumptions. You're there and you're saying, oh, that's really a problem.
You hadn't thought of that.
Hadn't thought of that. Well, yeah. There was no way for me to think about that.
Yeah. Right? And so give an example, if you can. I'm sure you have many of a situation, a company, an organization, whatever it might be, that took this approach and just radically sort of rethought itself.
Sure, there's so many of them. One of my so we've done thousands of projects, right? So mostly I like to tell the most recent story. And so the one that comes to mind is looking at San Francisco Unified School District and looking at, you know, the kind of problems with lunch. You know, kids, you look at lunch, they're not eating lunch. You know, it's not like the best time of the day. It's, you know, it's just not happening. So we're asked to look at that. And so the mindset of that was, let's figure out how to have a better meals, right, or lunch. And when we got in, and when you're there, you know, you see the kids and how loud it is and people trying to get them to be quiet, and that's not going to be possible, right? And so you have to give yourself over to that what needs to be designed there is not lunch, but an extraordinary social experience, because that's what the kids want, right? They've been all day in classes and not with their actual pals. Now they're in this lunch thing, and so what they really want is to have a great social experience, and then we'll slip a little food in, right, to the side. And so when you look at it, they're not eating, they weren't eating because they wanted to spend time with their friends. They're not eating their fruits and vegetables because they're teenagers. And, you know, and so by understanding that, making that reframe of the problem to it's about an extraordinary social experience, the whole thing was able to be changed.
How?
So if you look at it like you don't focus on the food, you focus on the kids being together. So when they come in, they sit in tables together. You know, they don't wait in lines, or you have so many lines that the line is what's keeping them from being with their friends.
Eats into their social time.
Yeah, exactly. Eats into their social. So you get rid of that. You have them help serve the food. You serve it at round tables. We serve the fruits and vegetables first when there's nothing else and they're hungry. They eat it. This is like a epiphany that we found a way for the kids to eat the fruits and vegetables because they were throwing them away before that,
yeah.
Right? And then you just do things that make them both have their lunch and enjoy the experience. And the end result, I mean, one of the ways the end results you see is that the school district now has an innovation center where they use our way of thinking to solve all kinds of problems, not just the lunch problems. So we know we've had impact.
So they've transformed the school lunch.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I know that one of the most famous clients or collaborators you've had is Steve Jobs. And you met him in 1979,
I think. That's about right. Yes.
Yeah. Describe that first meeting with him.
Well, you know, he was he mellowed as he got older. So if I go back to the very beginning, it was pretty raw. You know, I mean, he was full of himself and doing great things. Apple II had just come out. But as a designer, I loved everything about him in that he did everything with intention. You know, if you're a designer, you know, you care about, you know, how the pen feels in your hand and what shoes you wore today and, you know, how easy it is to park and, you know, all those things that, you know, like we kind of keep a continuous mental bug list. And he wanted to do everything in a most extraordinary and sustainable way. So he wasn't just a crazy person who wanted to do things in an extreme way. He wanted to do them in an extreme way that was also sustainable, that also make an impact in the world. And I found that super interesting.
And extreme, what do you mean by that?
Extreme, well, you know, I can remember we asked him to do a certain thing and he wanted it to be, well, there, I mean, I don't know if it's that interesting, but like a little casting that we would have just kind of just made it, you know, in a normal place. He wanted to look. He brought in his tone arm off of his probably $100,000 turntable, and he said, "I want it to look like this." And I kept saying, "Steve, that's like, you know, off of a $100,000 thing. We got to make it for 20 cents." But he said, you know, and he would say, "Come on, I thought you were good." He'd motivate you through.
Shame.
Shame. How, aren't you going to do it in the most extreme possible way, you know? And he drove you. I'm not sure that I ever made it to his expectation, but I made it well beyond my own expectation, you know, given how he would goad you into trying to do things in an extreme way.
And what were the circumstances of your meeting him?
I had just started IDEO, the company would become IDEO, and one of my former friends at Stanford was working for him already. I don't know how they met. And they were exploding, and they just needed our kind of talent. They needed design, product design, we call ourselves then, and we needed it. And so this alumni of Stanford, who was a couple of years ahead of me in the program, took us down to meet him. And I still have the badge that says temporary employee T1, temporary employee number one. I doubt that I was the first employee, but I as a memento, I have this Apple badge with the funny colored apple, and I still have the badge I wore when I first met him.
Oh, that's great. Unfortunately, it didn't come with stock options, probably.
No, I never, you know, in fact, I became so close to him, hanging with him when we were bachelors together, and then he introduced me to my wife, and we were just working on so many projects, and I'm not very sophisticated financially, so I never bought stock because I was afraid it would be seen as, you know,
conflict.
Yeah.
And you designed Apple's first commercially sold mouse. Mm-hmm. Describe that process. What were you trying to accomplish?
So what had happened there was that we went up to see Xerox PARC, and Xerox PARC had basically invented the whole computer. They pulled down menus. They had a thing called Star and Alto, and they had computer systems. But it was all in a laboratory. It was a research facility, right? They weren't – and different things were made, you know, onesie-twosies. They weren't made for high volume like Apple was. And so as a result of that, Steve talked them into – he basically – talked them out of their technology. I mean, sitting here today, you know, he talked them out of the entire computer, you know, personal computer industry technology, Ethernet, everything. They had basically invented.
When you say talked them out of it, what do you mean? They revealed everything?
Yeah, they revealed everything, and then he was allowed to use the technology. He gave them stock in Apple, I believe. Not enough, I'm sure, but we got right. And so once we'd seen that, he knew that's what he wanted in his computer. And so we were given the task of, you know, inventing a technology that was manufacturable for a mouse and the Apple III and a bunch of other projects at that moment. And
how many iterations did you go through before you got to the one?
Well, lots of them. I mean, lots of them. You know, a lot of people think, you know, Jobs had this uncanny ability to just guess what everybody was going to want next. And he was good at that, but the way he did that was we made a prototype and he showed it to all the smart people he knew, and he again badgered them into telling them what he thought, and then he'd come back to us and say, you know, I think he didn't always give credit to everybody that deserved it. I mean, he did sometimes, but he came back and said, you know, here's what I think is wrong with it. And in some ways, it's just an attitude of caring about everything, right? So in normal things, we kind of look at constraints. We kind of pass over them because we don't want to talk. It's like takes too long or we're not that sensitive. But he would come back and say, of that prototype that you showed me, you know, I think the screws should be CAD plated instead of nickel plated. I didn't know what he knew what the tooth difference was. I did, but I was because I'm an engineer.
Why did that matter?
It mattered to him because of the look of the interior of the machine that, you know, he's famous for the circuit boards had to be more beautiful instead of more functional, right?
Even though no one was really going to see it.
Yeah, it's on the inside.
Yeah. Talking with David Kelly, he is the founder of IDEO and Stanford's D School, and also co-author of Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within All of Us. What is creative confidence, David?
Well, creative confidence is really the kind of natural human ability that we all have to come up with good ideas and the kind of courage to act on it. So, so often we see that kids at some point opt out of thinking of themselves as creative. If you go into a kindergarten class and say, who's artistic, who's creative, everybody raises their hand enthusiastically. By the time you get to about the fifth grade, if you ask that question, you know, one girl raises her hand, everybody else looks on the floor nervously. And what's happened is some event, some teacher, some student, somebody has told them, look, you're not an artist, you can't draw, or, you know. So, I mean, you know, you can, I wasn't a sports person, so I opted out of thinking of myself as an athlete, right? But some large percentage of kids opt out of thinking of themselves as creative.
But is there a difference between thinking you're not an athlete and thinking you're not creative? Because, you know, not everybody can throw the ball like Tom Brady or Johnny Unitas.
You know? No, that's true.
Can everyone be creative?
Yes, I do think everybody can be creative. And so, but I mean, everybody can be athletic if they want to work at it. And, you know, I mean, it's just like, no, you can't be a professional basketball player, but you can have a life of enjoyment of sport, even though it's not, you know, your forte. But in our case, everybody's wildly creative, and we've proven it over and over again as we try to unlock that from people, from adults. But so by getting creative confidence is a bigger deal than just about can you draw by a long shot. I mean, the famous psychologist Albert Bandura calls it what I'm talking about, calling self-efficacy. And he thinks the most important thing to kind of self-esteem is the sense that you kind of have a sense of the world and that you can accomplish what you set out to do. So if you believe, not that you have like super high goals or anything, but that what you set out to do, that you can accomplish that. That's like super important to happiness and all those kind of things. And that's what I'm talking about, is that you have the confidence that you can come up with an idea and actually make it happen.
And how much of that do you think at a younger age is due to parents or mentors or teachers really nurturing you and nurturing that?
Yeah, it is. It's 100%. You think about that. I mean, who plays the piano today are the ones that the piano teacher said, man, you're really good at this piano.
Or the parents said, you've got to go to lessons, whether or not you like it.
Well, I don't think those people turn out to necessarily. But if you're encouraged.
What do you mean by that? That distinction.
If you're encouraged, right, I think that kind of opting in yourself that this is your thing, however you're motivated, compared to somebody telling you to do it, is night and day about whether you take it on as a life experience. But with respect to creative confidence, what happens is the fear that you have, and we've looked at this over and over, the fear that you have is the fear of being judged by others. That's what keeps you from being creative, is that you're fearful that you're going to say something and other people are going to say, that's a terrible idea, or that, you know, they're not going to embrace this thing that's so precious to you, your idea.
And as adults, a lot of that has to do with the culture of the place you work at, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so, you know, a lot of the work that IDEO gets these days is, you know, helping companies change their cultures to be more innovative, to innovate routinely and to have that nurturing role to people with ideas.
And can you apply that to any organization? I mean, for example, could you apply it to the military?
I think you can. We get a lot of requests from the military. I think you can. I mean,
kind of requests do you get from the military? Can't you talk about it?
No, I mean, we work for everybody. I mean, it's not just military, for the government, for, you know, medical industry, for the hospitality industry, for, you know, you name it. We work for it because I think what's happened is the world has gotten complex enough that people are looking for new ways to come up with ideas, right? Because the old way of just extending the present direction we're going is not working. People really need a kind of a cathartic reframing of their whole. Well, look at, I mean, if you were in, you know, in the media industry, or you're in the hospitality industry, and something like Airbnb hits you, or you're a taxi service and you Uber hits you and stuff, you've got to be thinking in an extraordinary way about what direction your business could go. And so I think that people look to our kind of people, these people that can come up with ideas that affect the culture completely. Because what people, there's a big IBM survey, and you ask CEOs, 1,500 CEOs, what was the number one thing on their list? And that was the number one thing on the list, that they could find a way for their company to routinely innovate, that their culture changed for one of kind of purely execution to one on on that came up with breakthrough ideas, and they could put lots of them on the shelf, and then they could pull them down when they needed them.
I don't know if you have watched the series Mad Men.
I did a little bit.
A little bit. Did you see the finale last weekend? Mm. Okay. Well, I mean, I just, that show, of course, is about it's about a lot of things, but it's about the creative process, you know? And I don't know if you've even read about the ending, but it was about how that iconic Coke ad was made in 1971 where, you know, I'd like to buy the world a Coke, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Based on what you did see of the series, what do you make of their interpretation, their take on the creative process?
Ad agencies are incredibly creative. You have to be. You know, in fact, when I give a speech somewhere, I'm like really disappointed if I'm behind an ad guy because they're going to run their reel of, you know, and the stuff that didn't get on the air is even more creative than the stuff that did. But the thing I take about ad agencies is I think that in some ways they do a world a little bit of a disservice because they divide the people in the ad agency into the creatives and the non-creatives. And I think everybody's creative, right? And so I think that the other people that they were calling the non-creatives, you know, the receptionists and the accountants and all those things, should be challenged to do their job in a creative way. We try to, at IDEA, we try to make every person a designer. We say, you're a designer. You know, you're the receptionist. You're a designer. And so we had a receptionist named Vicky, and she took that to heart. And so she looked at her job, and she saw that she was really good at knowing the mood of the company because everybody walked by her desk and she knew them. So she decided she'd do something about it. So she just decided who was having the worst day, and then she'd have a milkshake delivered to their desk. That's a creative receptionist. I thought, what a great thing.
What the D School at Stanford, which you helped found, has incorporated that idea in across disciplines and departments, and it's been used now for curriculum and administration, facilities, all those things. How did you get Stanford to do that? Was there resistance to that?
I don't know about resistance, but, you know, anytime you're dealing with that kind of organization, you've got a habit that you've got to figure out how to break. I proposed that for many years to Stanford. Stanford was definitely interested in multidisciplinary things. We just weren't very good at it yet. And now we are. So when I kind of got tenure and could do anything I wanted, I started teaching with different people. Instead of staying home and teaching only my students, which were all engineering students, I started teaching with an art professor, with a computer science professor, with a business school professor. And the moment for me was when I saw the kids' eyes light up when the three of us were standing in front of the classroom and we would be fighting. You know, because we cared so much about the subject we were talking about, we would basically have a philosophical, not, you know, punches.
Passion.
Passion and fight. And I saw the eyes sparkle in the kids. And I said, we got something here. And so I proposed it to the university. This gentleman, Hassel Plattner, came up with the money. And so it helped to have a lot of money, you know, to be founded with the $40 million. But when we started, it's just turned out to be exactly that way, which is multiple faculty who want to be there. They opt in. I don't pay the faculty anything. So they have to decide they really want to be there. And the students take the classes because they want to. They're not required.
And they're beating down the door to take those classes.
Yeah, they are.
Aren't they?
They are. I mean, which is great. And so it's a really vital place where everybody wants to be there, and everybody's engaged in this human-centered process. It just turned out to be great.
David Kelly, chair and founder of the design firm IDEO, and founder of Stanford's D School. Co-wrote the book Creative Confidence with his brother Tom. And if you'd like to join us, give us a call, 866-733-6786. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim. Stick around. And welcome back to Forum. Our guest this hour, David Kelly. He's the author of Creative Confidence with his co-author, I should say, with his brother Tom. Creative Confidence, Unleashing the Creative Potential Within Us All, is also the chair and founder of the design firm IDEO, founder of Stanford's D School. And we'd love to hear from you for the rest of this hour. Give us a call. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your comments. It's forum@kqed.org, or you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum, or leave a message on our Facebook page if you'd like. David, we were talking during the break again about that Mad Men episode that ends up at a Esalen-like place on the coast down near Santa, Big Sur. And you said that a lot of the ideas that you have worked with have come from Est. Tell me about that.
So my mentor and the guy who started the program, I now have his job, but was a guy named Robert McKim. And he really benefited a lot from working with Warner Earhart, and they taught sessions together and stuff. And it was this whole thing of kind of mindfulness and opening up to this kind of environment and the stuff around us. And you know, for an engineering professor, you know, this was a pretty big deal. And many of the things that we taught, including starting all classes with improv and getting people to do things rather than trying things, all came from that experiences that Bob had at Est.
And that was a big thing when I moved to California in 1981. So it really had an impact in lots of ways.
Yeah, it did. I mean, you know, I was raised in Ohio, and I'm sure it seemed flaky from that distance to the people in Ohio. But once I got out here, it made a lot of sense to me.
What were you like as a kid growing up in Ohio?
I was a kind of kid that, you know, like tore things apart and put some of them back together.
but not all of them.
No, but I mean, I was just, I was kind of left. I mean, I didn't have any real constraints. My parents were kind of leftist, you know. I mean, you know, I mean, you know, benign neglect, I think, was their approach. And so we ended up, you know, building tree forts and tearing the washer apart and trying to figure out how to put it back together and making parts. And so it was a kind of a hands-on, so this kind of maker movement would have was not necessary if you had that kind of upbringing. But you know, it just was very nurturing. Do what you want to do. I mean, my favorite story is that at 12, I got a brand new bike, a red bike, and the next day I took it out into the garage and sandblasted it and painted it a different color. You know, perfectly good bike, right? And I'm surprised my parents didn't say, "What'd you do to the bike I just bought you?"
But what color did you paint it?
Day glow green. It was terrible.
And your brother, same, you guys were?
Yeah, my brother's always been a bit more conventional. He's than me, but he's very diligent. He's a fantastic public speaker, and he's always kind of, it's always been lovely to have your younger brother in the company. You know, when in the early days when I would leave, you know, I didn't have to worry about what was going on because we're so like-minded. It was great. It's been great. And our whole lives, we've been close.
All right, let's go to the phones now if we can. And again, that number to call, 866-733-6786. And we'll begin in Menlo Park with Wynn. You're on with David Kelly. Good morning.
Thank you. About a year ago, I sent you a resume in the hopes that as a senior citizen, I could be of value to you in some of your research. And so my question is, and you were kind enough to forward my resume on, so I still have hopes that it's in the mill. But my question really is, what are you doing in the nature of things to develop things for seniors? Because we're all becoming older and things that we're used to don't work as well anymore. Is there a focus on the senior activity?
Yes, seniors is actually a really big focus on us. And I think you got beat out in the resume race there with Barbara. I don't know if you saw, there's a big article in the Wall Street Journal. We just hired a woman who's 90 years old, and she helps with the teams. But we certainly do. Any place where there's lots of opportunity for having empathy for people and solving problems that haven't been solved before, and certainly, you know, as you get older, people haven't focused on the kind of things that can happen. We're one step beyond that. I mean, most of the press we've been getting recently is about our work in the experience of dying. So death. If you type in IDEO and depth into Google, you'll see that one of the things we're doing, and that's.
You're working with the Zen Hospice.
Yes. And that pulls back to, okay, how are you going to have an extraordinary experience as an older person? You know, what's different? What can you do that is that way? And so, it's like any group, whether we're working with millennials or people that are over 65, the same kind of process relates that trying to understand what's the non-obvious things or the things that would delight them. And so we do actually have a focus on that.
What's Barbara's last name?
Oh, what's Barbara's last name, Wynn's asking.
You know, I'm blanking. I'm an old man. So there's Barbara's. Like, maybe we need some.
Go read the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, well, read the Wall Street Journal, yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Wynn. Let's go to now Sacramento. And Kyra or Kira, welcome.
Hi, it's Kyra.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm just loving the conversation that you're having with David. And I work as a scientist in a very large federal agency. And for 18 years, I've been pushing the boulder uphill. I feel like Sisyphus. And I just was looking for advice and encouragement for those of us who are square pegs and round holes and trying very hard and with much success usually to be collaborative. But sometimes it's easier just to give up and give in to the engineering and the scientific norms in our organization. But how do we stay the course and try to keep embracing this and bring our colleagues along?
Yeah, you know, it's actually a real problem in all of our exec ed programs. When people go back to their actual job, that's their biggest concern, is that how will they, you know, break the habits of their organization in order to get this new way of thinking. Although they're very turned on, it's a lot of times squelched by the organization they go back to. And so we're working quite hard on that and making sure that that's from day one in an executive ed program, that that they're planning how they're going to go back. So there's a few ideas that we've seen in my experience that work. The first one that comes to mind from your question is what we call double delivering. So you're expected to do things in a certain way. And if you don't do those, it would be a bad thing. You know, you wouldn't be seen as a team player, and you wouldn't, may not even have a job after that. But do that. And then to, just as an exemplar for your company, for your boss, do it. You know, put together a little team or do it yourself or something, and do it in the way that we talk about, in the human-centered way. Go out, you know, and somehow this is not offensive to companies. If you bring in a kind of a second solution to the problem, to whatever extent you can do that, and then they see the difference. I mean, it's like, it's somehow you got to make it tangible. The way companies change, that and agencies change, we do a lot of work with government agencies in Washington, D.C., and the way they change is they really can't imagine the kind of solution set that we're coming up with. And so
can you give an example of a solution you came up with and there was so much resistance to it for whatever reasons, practical reasons, cost, whatever it might be, and then ultimately was adopted?
Well, there's always resistance to the new idea. So, basically everything that you come up with seems to be that way. But then once you see the fit, if you look at I was initially involved in the design of ATM machines. And you can imagine you go to the bank and you say, hey, we got this idea. We're going to cut a big hole in the side of your bank and let people take cash out. These guys have spent their whole life making the bank walls very secure. And we want to cut a hole in and let people take cash out through it, right? And so, but if you have a little initial success, so the goal of this double delivering I'm talking about is showing a little initial success. It's been my experience that if you have none, I mean, if like that nobody's ever seen a pivoted out of the box kind of solution that's actually sustainable. So the idea has to be both extraordinary, which is what we're always going through, a breakthrough, but it also has to be sustainable and fit in the organization. They mostly think that all kind of these crazy design ideas are not going to actually be work in their organization. So back to the double delivering, you come up with this idea and they think, oh, wow, that's kind of interesting that we – And
it's
they
kind
don't
like an extra credit project.
Yeah, exactly. They don't. I mean, we don't find that immediately the whole organization changes, or that you become VP of innovation the next week. But what happens is, what people report is in the double delivering scenario is that they're given a more interesting project the next time, and the next time, and the next time. And we've had a couple of them where the double delivering group didn't have any place to meet, so they were like meeting in the hall and making too much noise. So the company or the organization finally gave them a space. Then once you have an innovation space,
you're off and running
because there's something about having your own space. Another idea is if you can get that done somehow, because there's something about when you walk into the innovation space, you're allowed to act differently. So even the kind of straight-laced, you know, people who are very detail-oriented about the doing it the way that they've done it in the past, somehow if you have a space that you're allowed to act differently, a lot of them kind of let their hair down and act differently as well.
Kyra, what do you think of that? Is that that double delivering, is that an idea that you could work with?
Absolutely, and you're actually describing a lot of things that we're doing. And, you know, even though we're told to stay in our lane, you know, and not, you know, cause any disruption in the way things are done, we're actually having tremendous success, and everything you just described actually does work. So I'm glad to hear that there's hope for us because we are going to change the way our federal agencies operate.
Look at it like you got a little brush fire going, and that maybe it'll turn into a big forest fire if once people see.
Well, we don't want forest fires, but metaphorically. All right, Kyra.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for being such a visionary. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Kyra, for the call. 866-733-6786 is the number to call if you want to ask David Kelly a question or a comment. You said you're doing a lot of work for government. Can you think of, what's an example of, especially, you know, at the state or federal level government that you've really had an impact on the delivery of services or their approach?
I'm not the government guy. So I've just been recently to Washington, D.C. and gave a talk, and I was surprised to see in the IDEO office there just this big a map of D.C. and all the different agencies that we're doing. But they're talking a lot about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau project that we've done. You know, that's the agency that was the only real agency that's been founded after Homeland Security. That's the only one that's really been founded.
And that came out of the home foreclosure, the crash of the market.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so when we looked and when we went in there and look at that, in our process is to just go deep into empathy. And you find out that people are really concerned about, you know, funding college and to refinancing their houses and stuff. And if you apply our kind of stuff to that, you start to see, human-centric ways to do that work both for the government and work for, the population. And so those kind of projects are pretty straightforward. I mean, you know, the truth is a lot of what we do is common sense. It's just that we are loaded. We are like expert at what people actually care about, and so that makes it easier. You don't have to come up with a policy and then worry about whether people are going to like resonate with it. We know what they resonate with, and then we go to try to find a policy that fits that rather than the other way around.
So it's more like a bottom up design.
Yeah, absolutely. Common sense.
Common sense. Here's a question from a listener who writes, any advice for what to do when your new supervisor questions your creative acumen and integrity and is unwilling to chat?
That sounds like a double whammy. You know, get a new job. I mean,
yeah,
that sounds like they're stupid. But,
people are threatened, can be threatened by this sort of approach, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the kind of, it's like working with creative types is not for everybody, you know, because there's a kind of a follower mentality that's threatened by this. But there's nothing like actual success. So if you can you hope that your organization is a meritocracy, meaning that by coming up with a solution that is really empathetic to the people you're trying to delight or you're trying to please, and that it really works, that it won't be rejected if it's compelling enough. And if it is, then you're just in a situation where it's, you know, that's not possible to change. But, our experience is usually that if you come up with a really human-centered approach, it's so empathetic to the people that are involved that you can get testimonials. One of the things we do a lot of times is show just tons of video of people, you know, like saying this would be really good for me. I'd really, really like this, you know, stuff. And it's a little hard even for the kind of most out of touch boss. It's a little hard to
ignore it.
Ignore that.
Yeah. Here's an interesting tweet. Adiba asks, how can creativity be used to address police violence against black men and women? And do you know, have you worked with police departments?
I'm sure we have, although I'm not familiar with specific things. We've certainly worked with the military and dealing with wounded warriors and helping veterans with PTSD and stuff like that. But as far as the you know, this is kind of like my religion, so I wouldn't believe me exactly. But I don't think there's very few things that aren't human-based problems that can't be looked at where you're trying to really understand and have empathy for what the situation is. The thing that I would think about in that particular case is it's so hard to do a prototype. One of our approaches is always try something, right? Instead of talking about it a lot, try something. Make everybody aware that you're doing an experiment. If it doesn't work, we're going to pull it back. And a lot of times when you actually do pull it back, it gives people confidence that you are honest that it was a prototype, not a new policy that everybody has to follow. And so I'd be tempted in those kind of situations to try to get to a situation, even if you have to do it in pick a community and say, look, this is our prototype community. We're going to bring everybody together and we're going to try this. Because when you read that, the problem seems so big, I don't think anybody can solve it. But if you could break it down into some piece of it and do a prototype and kind of publicize what happened. And in that prototype, you usually learn by doing something as opposed to talking about something. You tend to learn information that allows you to come up with a better solution, right? So a little less talking and a little more doing usually results in a discussion between the parties. They have something to talk about. They have a physicality to talk about.
And there's this philosophy, too, of embracing failure.
Yes, absolutely. Failure, I'm not a big fan of failure in general, but I'm a big fan of doing stuff and allowing failure to be instructive. And it's kind of like, in organizations, the ability to be transparent and to actually say, I don't think that worked, and instead of having – and being able to say that to the boss, and that talking about the failure is a way of caring about the other person or caring about the organization rather than kind of sugarcoating everything because you're afraid that it's going to bring conflict. Because those conflicts – I mean, think about how many families would be better if they actually talked about what was going on rather than not. And so I think it's the same way with this kind of organization.
All right. Jeff in Sebastopol, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call. David, I was hoping you could talk a little about a little more details about your school at Stanford. In regards to the classes and the demographics, I'm kind of within this theme of individuals who are calling, who are somewhat constrained in their organizations in terms of their ability to innovate. And I'm wondering if that your classes in your school provides opportunities to help people find their way. I've got two girls who go to very expensive colleges, so I don't really have the option to quit right now. But I'm trying to segue, and I'm wondering a little bit more about your school.
Okay, David.
Yeah. So, well, congratulations that your daughters are getting an education that you're proud of. Clearly, so the school is about human-centered design. So it's about how you go about innovating routinely. How do you find breakthrough ideas? And as far as the logistics of it, I mean, we have classes online. You can take the crash course. We have IDEO has IDOU. There's you can come to places like Stanford and take a workshop. There's other places around the world doing the same kind of stuff that's picked up on it. So there's lots of opportunity to learn about the actual detail. But back to what I was saying before, the only way I know to kind of fix the problem inside of a company that's not getting it, other than shaming them into going to Stanford and taking an exec ed, or offering them the information, if we could get five people in your company to have an immersive experience around design thinking, I think it would change them.
All right, Jeff, thanks very much for the call. You're listening to Forum. We're talking to David Kelly, founder of IDEO and the D School at Stanford. And as you may have noticed, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. David, what do you think are the limits of creative design, human-centered design?
I said a little bit ago, it's kind of like my religion, so it's kind of hard for me to see those limits. I think it kind of can apply. It's just a tool that can apply to almost anything. But the way the problems are framed, or if the problem is so specific that there's no room to move, like if the constraints are so narrow that you really have already defined the problem. Design thinking requires you to really be allowed to do what we call need finding as a way of starting rather than problem solving. Because when you state a problem very specifically, you're already leading to the solution. You're already giving away what you think the solution is just by the way it's – so we never – we never like to start with a problem. We like to start with what we call a how might we statement. How might we improve the experience of taking Caltrain? How might we improve the experience, for firemen in Peru? Allowing the problem to change as a result of you becoming more informed, and as you work on the problem, you become more expert and you say, ooh, look, there's a problem. It's a little over here, but that's the one that would make the impact. But our limit is really if the problem statement is locked in and you don't have the flexibility to move to a better problem, then design thinking is of marginal value, because you could just do a problem. You could do a kind of an engineering analytical solution. So if it's purely an analytical problem, then we probably don't have a lot to offer.
I mentioned that the California Report team worked with the D School a few weeks ago, months ago now, to focus on some specific questions about how do we reach more millennials. And we did a lot of empathy interviews, went out into the community, talked to folks. And it was such a it was such a great respite, I think, first of all, from the day-to-day grind. You get yourself away from what you're doing on a daily basis and get out and listen to people. And as you say, it challenges a lot of assumptions. And once you get out of that way of thinking, things that you didn't necessarily weren't focusing on also come to mind. There's unexpected benefits, I think.
Yeah, I mentioned that we were talking about a minute ago with respect to S was about McKim, and he said to me one day, a fish doesn't know he's wet. And for some reason, that always stuck with me, right? I mean, that's what it is that you're in the middle of this all the time. And so that there's this land stuff out there never occurred to you. Why would it, right?
All right, let's see if we can get another couple calls in here. Let's go to Berkeley. Kate, you're on the phone. Welcome with David Kelly.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and thank you, David, for your incredible work. I want to ask you if you feel like there's a difference in the mindset of the person who finds the problem or finds the need versus the person who solves the problem. I'm saying this because I heard a talk with Daniel Pink where he was referencing a study from University of Chicago in the 1960s where they studied art students to find out who were the top performers, and they found that the students who asked the question, what good drawing can I produce, who they identified as the problem finders, versus the students who asked, how could I produce a good drawing, who are the problem solvers. And they found that the students who asked the question, you know, what good drawing can I produce? The problem finders were actually the ones who were able to finish their project and become the top performers and become artists.
Hmm.
But my understanding of your design thinking process, you incorporate both process, right? So
Yes. I would say that's true. First, the really good news is that we believe that this innovation space is a team sport. So I used to give tasks and have individuals do projects like an art project, and you would own it, and you know, because it was an artist, like a painting, you don't share your painting with other people. But since design has moved to a team process, the good news is you can have both problem finders and problem solvers on your team, which is great. And so we look for that. But in general, I think you are bringing up an interesting point, which is around, we call it need finding rather than problem finding, but it's the same thing. And that making that valued, I mean, that brings many more interesting people into the mix. Because when it was back to problem solver, problem solver, problem solver, you were more moved towards, like, you know, engineers and those kind of people. In a world where you want both problem finders and problem solvers, it opens the world up to, you know, to anthropologists and opera singers and, you know, anything you can think of, that people who have a unique view on the world are capable of coming up with really interesting needs. And so so the explosion has been in allowing other people into doing this kind of work because of what you describe as the problem finding.
All right, Kate, thanks so much for the call. And we are out of time. David Kelly, thanks so much for being here. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For Mina Kim and all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.